Welcome to the 220th episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Rutherford. Stay tuned for my interview with Lynn Rosen, author of the novel, A Man of Genius. Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Lynn Rosen, author of A Man of Genius. Lynn, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Great. Well, can you read the first two or three pages of A Man of Genius?
I'd be glad to. The excerpt I'm reading is from the prologue. I admit I'm a misanthrope. My disdain for people is bred of age and experience and a tinge of self-deprecation. Having finally arrived at that stage in life called retirement, I claim the right to a Garbo-esque attitude. I want to be left alone. I fought the battles of life and won most of them. I'm what might be regarded as a successful man, all of which has earned me the right to sit in a corner and meditate. On what? On whatever I damn please. That's just what I was about, only it wasn't a corner. It was a deserted veranda I sat on at a lodge in the Canadian Rockies. I was enjoying my solitude, resting in the tranquility of the dimming light, vaguely aware of the sounds of birds and the rustle of leaves, musing on nothing in particular, minus the angst of worrying about tomorrow or ruining events of the past. Life was as it was, is as it is, and was going to be whatever. Adding to my successful disengagement was the fact that I had finally arrived at a welcome point where I accepted the fact that whatever came next in my life, I cared little or nothing about. Little wonder that I was more than annoyed when I heard footsteps approaching. She came through the terrace door, and I stood behind my chair. Good evening, Mr. Dollinger. I guess you prefer this to what's going on inside. Her tone was whimsical. Quite right. I had little interest in a corporate retreat. I find the word retreat, as applied to these planning sessions, nonsensical. Why would a corporation plan to retreat? A bad descriptor. What's more, I have little or nothing to do with a corporation's future, so why be involved in its planning? I'm aware that I'm here merely as a trophy, a retired founding partner who's added considerably to the firm's coffers, merely a symbol of can and what should be accomplished. No, I'll leave the gaming to the youngsters. She laughed. That's more than I had the pleasure of hearing from you in some time. Uninvited, she settled into the seat next to me. I turned to face her, curious to see what she'd become. She wore a dark parka, and she tucked a blanket around her legs and over her boots, so that she seemed to merge with the darkness. Yet the early evening light, blending with the light that sifted through the terrace doors, allowed me a dimmed view of her face. She was many years younger than I, and though I'm a confirmed bachelor, I've always enjoyed the sight of a handsome woman. She surely was that. She sat erect in the chaise and looked outwardly with a steady stare, simply sat and waited. I was taken by her assured attitude, so different from when we first met in some years earlier, at the time of her interview at the law firm of Batten, Dollinger, Mills, and Dupre, a firm I had founded. That was in the mid-80s when she was 29 and fresh out of law school. She came with a strong recommendation from my law school roommate, a renowned misogynist, which made me curious about her. Though there was nothing exceptional in her appearance, I clearly remembered what she had looked like. She presented a picture of propriety and confidence. She wore the attire of a professional woman, the mannish suit with a modest skirt length, the Hathaway shirt, the plain, shiny pumps with moderate heels, the simple touch of pearl jewelry, the subtle cosmetics. Her face was oval. Her shining brown hair was drawn back in a bun. She was long-legged and probably shapely beneath her attire. Clearly, Carlisle Richards was eager to be a team player and therefore willing to blend in. She became an associate in the firm's mergers and acquisitions division. She didn't share the same area of specialization, and I lost contact with her except for the occasional hallway or elevator encounter. But somewhere I had stored the memory of Carlisle Richards, and I called upon it 2 years after our initial meeting upon the death of the famed architect, Samuel Grafton Hall. I'd known Samuel for many years. I greatly admired his work, and I took pride in the belief that we were friends. He was also one of my most eminent clients, so I was particularly concerned about the stipulation in his will that required special attention. I looked up Carlisle's current assignment status, found her to be reasonably available, and thinking the assignment might be advanced by a woman's touch, called on her services. And then we met again, many years later, on the veranda of a lodge in the Canadian Rockies during a corporate retreat. With no assistance from me, she had become a partner in the firm. She sat next to me, no longer shy. Her unwavering silence commanded my attention, and I capitulated. "Tell me, are you enjoying the occasion?" I asked, with feigned interest in her answer. "No more than you," she replied. "I've arrived where I want to be. The corporate challenges are behind me, too. No need to pay those dues again." "But you've accomplished so much." She laughed slightly. That first rush of pride in what I'd achieved is long gone. Truth is that what I enjoyed most about my success was bringing it home. After all, what first-generation professional female from a middle-class background with two successful older brothers wouldn't relish rushing home to announce that she'd been named partner in one of the most prestigious law firms in the country? She awakened memories of my own career and the choices I had made. It seemed obvious from a meteoric rise that we were both spurred by the sirens of ambition. How, I wondered, had she gotten from her past to her present? How much had she conceded? Before I could find a comfortable way to pry into her life, she asked, "How well did you know Samuel Grafton Hall?"
Great. Well, if someone listening hasn't heard about A Man of Genius yet, how would you describe your novel?
Well, I would describe it as telling a story about an architect, Samuel Grafton Hall, who is a man of genius, and his life and the elements of his genius. But the main point about the character is that he demands reverence. And he is a man who is more than slightly flawed. He's a misanthrope. He's a womanizer. He leaves a swath behind him of people who are hurt by his actions. And yet he has very little moral fiber in him himself. The novel, because of what it deals with in this character and the reactions of the other characters towards this man, I hope raises questions about what we do owe to those that we set up as idols. What are the criteria that we apply to those decisions about who we trust? And the question then turns upon our own set of values and our own systems of moral obligation. Those sets of criteria that we set really define us. And I hope that the reader is pushed to that level. And finally, to the question in the plot line, because it's an open-ended conclusion, it's not a conclusion, to the point of saying, what would I have done?
Great. Well, do you remember the original idea or impetus that led you to writing A Man of Genius?
Indeed, I do. Because anything I write, and though I haven't published that much, I have drawers full of manuscripts of novels. And they all come from a memory. And the memory, of course, has been changed in time at my age. Memory's dim. But they have been taken on new forms. But all of the memories that are the impetus for the stories that I write about are something that leads me to think about more universal questions, and that's what pushes me to the writing. This particular book has a backstory to it, and it goes back to 1949 or 1950, when I was an undergraduate at the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. And I had seen and visited some of the prairie houses in Chicago that Frank Lloyd Wright had designed. And I also had visited some of the houses in the Madison area that he had designed. And I found a way to get even closer to his work at what I considered the very heart of his work area, which was Taliesin in Spring Green. And it was about 100 miles outside of Madison. And it wasn't easy to get there because you couldn't rent cars in those days, and I didn't have a driver's license. So I did manage to get some friends of mine to go with me, and we went off to Taliesin. When we arrived there, we discovered that it wasn't a day that there were going to be any tours, and so there was no access to the house. And we started squabbling over who had made the mistake of selecting this day. Now, none of my friends were the least bit interested in Frank Lloyd Wright or his work, but I had tempted them to go because I had said that there were apprentices in the studios working there, all men, all bereft of any female companionship, and would be delighted to see some co-eds from the university. And that was their temptation to go there. And there we stood, right in front of the door of Taliesin, arguing. And this woman came up to us and asked what was the problem, and we told her. And she introduced herself as Mrs. Frank Lloyd Wright, and she invited us into the house. I managed to get my friends an invitation to look at the studios and the projects that these young men were working on. And at the same time, I managed to ask for a guided tour by Mrs. Wright, and she was very nice about it and said she'd be glad to. And so off they went, and off I went. When I finished the tour, Mrs. Wright, her name is Algabana Wright, and she was Frank Lloyd Wright's third wife. She invited me to have some tea with her, and we sat in this great room at Taliesin. And she asked me what I thought of what I had seen. And I said I thought it was absolutely beautiful, but I would never want to live there. And we continued the conversation, and all through this discussion, there was a question on the tip of my tongue that I had to keep pushing back because I knew once out, everything was over. And the question I wanted to ask was, Mrs. Wright, did your husband kill his mistress? Because there had been a mistress, there was this Mawa Cheney and her children who had lived at Taliesin with Frank Lloyd Wright and been murdered in a horrific way. All murders are horrific. But this was particularly so because it was done by a hacksaw, mother and children. And it was done by a servant who later lit a fire to Taliesin and completely destroyed it. At the time, though Frank Lloyd Wright was at the Chicago exhibition, people thought that he had set up the situation and the murder because everyone knew about his liaison with Mawa Cheney, and there was a question of whether he was going to go to jail for it, because in those days morality issues were, in front and center, and he was losing all his clients, and so he was in a dreadful position because of this relationship, and would have done very well if he could have ended it. And so there it lingered, and I never asked the question. But the question stayed with me, and the incident stayed with me. And then I began to wonder, why? Why is it so important? Why does it stay with me? And that's how we come back around to what I had said before about the novel itself. Because it asks an open-ended question. And that open-ended question has no particular time relative to its importance. It's as important today as it was then, because we have so many idols today that we give our complete faith in people in media, people in religious organizations, people that we are willing to sit at the feet of and adore and forgive because everyone's imperfect. And that led me finally to A Man of Genius. But it is not that story, because years have changed the story. And my thinking about it has changed, and the center point of the story has shifted with, as I begin to raise questions.
Well, that's a great backstory. Great. Well, that's great insight into the novel. So I know that you taught literature and theater at the University of Rochester. What led you to teaching?
Oh, I've led a life of doing very many things, and it hasn't been one of those that you could say was a carpe diem life. It was probably the other way around. The day caught me and led me someplace, and all changes were not done with thoughtfulness. And I have a doctorate, and getting that doctorate was something that was not what I expected to do. I have two masters, a doctorate, little of which adds up to very much. But it was during the time that I had completed two masters, and it was a time in academe where, because of several circumstances nationally and internationally, there was a need for university teachers. And I had the degrees for it, and I was completing my dissertation. But I wasn't completing my dissertation in an area I wanted to complete it in because of attitudes towards women at that time. And so what I wanted to do was to accomplish a doctorate in the Gothic novel. Having completed two masters, I went and applied to the university for a doctoral program. And I was told that I couldn't be accepted. I wanted a full-time program. I had two children. I had other obligations. I just wanted to do it and then to become involved in the study of the Gothic novel. But I was told that I couldn't be accepted as a full-time a student because of my sex. This was before Title IX, and so you could say those things. And if I insisted on being considered, that they would sit me under the seminar table. Now, that's a quote that I remember. That is a quote. And so that I will sit you under the seminar table. There was a chairman of the Department of Education at the time who had come out of a very prestigious other institution, university, who heard about this and was so incensed that invited me to join a program in his department, which happened to be education. And we concocted a degree in higher education. At the time I completed that degree in higher education, there were only six people in the country whose area of interest was higher education. And then they asked me to join the faculty at the University of Rochester at the Eastman School of Music, and I became a assistant professor of humanities at the Eastman School in the Division of Humanities.
Great. Well, I know that earlier you said you had a drawer full of manuscripts you've written over the years. What advice would you have for aspiring writers who might be listening and are interested in writing their own novels or short stories?
I think that, from my own experience, I think that it's the joy of writing. And sometimes people think about what's going to happen afterwards, the publishing of the novel, the finishing of the novel. You may never finish the novel. The writing of A Man of Genius took a span of 15 years. 9 of them were in the actual writing. I think that it is the idea that has to compel you to write. And if you don't have this sense of compulsion, that's something that intrigues you, that's something you want to put down and figure out, that there's something that carries, again, the question, that you shouldn't do it. because not in the form of a novel. You know, you can do other things mm-hmm. with it, but I think that there are a novel is a different kind of a commitment in the intricacies of this expanded story. And so I think that don't think about the end, think about the process and really be committed to whatever you are addressing in the novel.
Great. Well, are there books and authors that you've read recently that impressed you and that you would recommend?
You know, I must tell you that I would recommend going back to the people that set the course for most of us. For instance, I think that one of the greatest novels ever written is Tristram Shandy. Now, I know that puts me in an odd category, but if you want to understand novel writing, go back to Tristram Shandy and think about it, and think about the how one works through time, think about plot line, and certainly in the Gothic novel, I go back to Anne Radcliffe, and those, so I am not a modernist in any way. I do go back and read and read and read. I think that there are writers, you know, particularly Allende and people like that, that did, you know, that really are excellent novelists in certain genres, and certainly magical realism and those aspects. She is a really impressive novelist. And so at times, you know, are others. But I do think that that one should go back and look at early novels. So few of them are reread.
Great. Well, are you working on another novel now?
I am. And by working on it, it begins in my head. And it's something, again, that happened to me and happened to me many, many years ago. And then again, in the late 1950s, it stayed with me. And I have no idea why it stayed there. It didn't take more than 5 minutes for the occurrence to happen and be over with, but it never left me. And I'm beginning to think that it has something in it that would be appealing to work on.
Great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Lynn Rosen, author of A Man of Genius. The novel is available in bookstores now, so go grab a copy. And Lynn, thanks for doing this interview.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Great. So this will go up in the next 2 or 3 weeks. I have a couple in the queue before you, and I'll just let your publicist know when it goes up, and there'll be a link to it.
That's great. Thank you so much. And
great.
I hope it works out well, and I really enjoyed doing it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I enjoyed it as well. Have a good day.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.